The other day, I walked into the lobby of Madison's largest retirement community. It's called Oakwood Village. And I was there to make a presentation and lead a discussion on a prearranged topic. And I've been doing this on a regular basis, a monthly basis, for about the last 8 years in order to provide some liberal religious sustenance for the 40-plus Unitarian Universalists that call Oakwood their home. Many of them are physically unable to attend services these days at our meeting house. And over the past 26-plus years, I have watched most of these men and women as they have moved out of their professional careers into active retirement and then finally into a more sedentary lifestyle. I've presided at memorial services for some of their spouses, and I've celebrated the nuptials of some of their sons and daughters. Committed Unitarian Universalists, these folk faithfully turn out for the monthly programs, and they express sincere appreciation for my modest efforts. And I find all of this gratifying, but even more meaningful to me has been the mistake that several of them have recently made in addressing me. Just this past Wednesday, one of the women looked up as I came in the front door, and she said, "Oh, look, here comes Max." She was referring to my predecessor, Max Gabler, who served the society even longer than I have, for 35 years. And Max Gabler, by the way, was instrumental in the formation of this congregation here in Appleton. So between the two of us, Max and I can boast 62 years of service to the First Unitarian Society of Madison. And so our identities have become merged, fused in the minds of those who have been close to both of us. And although they sometimes catch their mistake and apologize for calling me Max, I dispel their embarrassment by saying, "Don't be sorry. Actually, you know, I'm flattered by it." But I didn't always feel that way. Because for the first decade of my ministry in Madison, I labored under the long shadow of Max Gabler. In all of my endeavors, I was compared favorably or unfavorably to my minister emeritus. If I wished to alter an administrative practice, someone would say, "That's not how Max did it." If I changed some small element of the Sunday liturgy, someone else would complain, "I like the way Max did it better." And moreover, because Max was minister emeritus in residence, he stayed in Madison, I was expected to carve out for him more than a token place in the ongoing life of the congregation. Now, granted, he could only function in a ministerial capacity at my express invitation, but I knew better than to interfere with the loyalty and the love that many of our older members retained for Max. And so, yes, I did ask him to preach twice a year. I did permit him to perform the occasional wedding in the meeting house. I honored frequent requests for him to deliver the eulogies at memorial services for long-term members. Now, Max was, I hasten to add, a warm and supportive colleague who often said that nothing would please me more than for Michael to build on my legacy and be even more successful. Despite his prominence in the community, he never interfered with, and he never openly questioned my own approach to ministry. And yet, I knew that Max still was having trouble letting go of a role that had largely defined him for almost 40 years. But Max was not really a problem for me. He and I had entered into a covenant, and we understood that it was in both of our best interests to reach some kind of a modus vivendi. But on the other hand, some members of the congregation were far less clear on the concept. It took 15 years before some of my members stopped referring to me as the new minister and comparing me over and over again to Max. But fortunately, I had resolved early on to be patient and forbearing and to bide my time until the community completed the slow process of letting go. And in this area, as in so many others, letting go can be very difficult. Whether it is a firmly held but outworn conviction, a codependent relationship, household clutter, or a deeply loved cat or dog that's suffering, whatever the object, whatever the interest, our first impulse is to hold on, to cling tightly to that which is familiar, that which is reassuring. Letting go moves us into unfamiliar territory where we feel more vulnerable and less sure of ourselves. But if we can relax into that uncertainty, then a welcome feeling may begin to arise within us, a newfound sense of freedom accompanied by an increased receptivity to new experiences, new relationships, and new interests. As Ram Dass, as Michael Carroll has said, we become pioneers who do not need to weigh ourselves down with a collection of fixed views and habits. We can travel light, retaining what is useful, letting go of whatever has become ineffective. As pioneers, we can become seasoned travelers who are well aware that anything can and does happen. In the selection that I shared earlier from Ram Dass, he described his own struggle to let go of that deep-seated need to be physically independent. And despite the fact that he had spent much of his adult life on a Hindu spiritual path that called for non-attachment, that called for renunciation, Ram Dass still chafed at the limitations imposed on him by his newly acquired disability. Letting go of that quintessential American virtue of self-reliance was really tough for him. Dependency, he said, is a significant hurdle not just for me, but for most people, especially given the values of our society. Being dependent, needing help, it makes us feel diminished because we value autonomy and independence so highly. We value taking care of others, he said. We shun the notion of being cared for ourselves. Now, in my 35 years of parish ministry, I have observed this dynamic that he describes played out over and over again in our congregations. We Unitarian Universalists are, generally speaking, an enterprising and a resourceful lot. And even in our faith communities, surrounded by supportive friends, we tend to minimize any personal difficulties that we might be facing. We seem to assume that ours is a community of the highly capable, rather than one in which people are open about and responsive to each other's cares. And so too often I have found individuals or families that are stricken with a serious illness, a job loss, divorce, or death, they stop coming. They cut out. They disappear rather than turn to the congregation for support in their time of need. It appears that for many of us, the prospect of dependency is anathema, which is truly unfortunate because our congregations, mine in Madison, yours here, we have an abundance of resources. We have cadres of volunteer caregivers who so often remain woefully underutilized because other people are so reluctant to exhibit any weakness or any inadequacy. To repeat again the words of Ram Dass, situations in which we become dependent can also be transformative experiences for all parties concerned. By allowing ourselves to reveal our need, we allow those around us an opportunity to help, which is a fundamental need that we all share. And by being open about our own dependency, we can help those around us to become free from their fears of dependency. A disability aside, and disability is tough, letting go is also an important but underappreciated part of the aging process, and we're all going to get older, folks. Jenny Joseph's well-known poem, Warning, begins with these lines that I'm sure you're familiar with. When I'm an old woman, I shall wear purple with a red hat which doesn't go and doesn't suit me. It is an endearingly popular piece, but relatively few readers, I would submit, take that message to heart. Because truth be told, most of us find it very difficult to let go of what we imagine polite society or our consumer culture expects from us, even when we have reached an age where it doesn't matter a fig anymore. And yet, few initiatives will produce more lightness of being, more renewed interest in life than this one, to stop worrying so much about what other people think about us. We must give ourselves permission to be, if we wish, just a bit more eccentric, not to draw attention to ourselves, but simply as an expression of our truest and most creative and unexpressed selves. Now, we don't have to wait until Social Security kicks in to begin moving in this direction. Maybe I ought to start practicing a little now, Jenny Joseph proposes, so the people who know me are not too shocked, not too surprised, when suddenly I'm old and begin to wear purple. Indeed, it is wise to practice, because this ability to let go can make the whole process of living and working and learning and relating and aging so much less stressful. Those who have never developed this ability, Ram Dass warns, will typically enter their old age fearful and inflexible, still clinging to the wealth, the power, the prestige, the possessions that they have accumulated over a lifetime. They are unable to find satisfaction in the process of cultivating a deeper and more authentic sense of self. And thus the final stage of life is marred by increased anxiety instead of being enhanced by the acquisition of deeper wisdom and grace. And you know, an excellent place to practice letting go earlier in our lives is in our role as parents. Well, I know that when my son was young, and he's 28 now, I found it very, very difficult to let go of my adult agenda, my personal interests, in order to be present with and for my son Kyle. And it was, letting go, one of the hardest things that I have ever done. I was totally unprepared for the magnitude of his daily and hourly needs. I could not figure out how to make room for him in an already busy lifestyle. To practice ministry effectively, I needed sleep, but my sleep was continually interrupted for the first 18 months of his life. He was what we call a wakeful child. Competitive running was for me in my mid-30s an overwhelming, a consuming passion, but now my training regime was suffering badly. But wanting to be a good enough, if not exemplary, father, that was important for me too, so I started that slow process of learning to let go. One day I woke up and I said to myself, you know, I've won enough road races for one lifetime. And I stopped competing. I still run, but I never compete in races anymore. And I deferred some of my important professional goals until Kyle was a bit older, a little more mature. And I began applying mindfulness meditation to this whole difficult project of parenting. And in time, I loosened up. I became less anxious. And gradually, what do you know, Kyle became calmer as well. And so with less struggle, a little more letting go, the father-son relationship actually began to blossom. I've decided that parenting is, in some respects, analogous to learning to ride a horse. You've got to let go. You've got to relax into the experience of horseback riding. The late Forrest Church, who served our church in Manhattan, New York for many, many years. He was born in Idaho, the son of Senator Frank Church. And although he had a Western upbringing, he described his own attempts at horsemanship as kind of problematic. He always felt uncomfortable sitting astride such a large animal. And so he would sit tensely in the saddle. He would grip the reins tightly. He would pull back on the horse's head, which only made the poor animal all that much more agitated. But watching him one day sitting on the fence of the corral, a wrangler yelled out to him and he said, "Forrest, you're making it far more difficult than it needs to be. Just loosen your hold. Don't try so hard to be in control of the horse. Let nature take its course." Well, that felt counterintuitive to Forrest Church, but he took the cowboy's advice and found the more I let up, the easier things became. And of course, what is true for horses and for children is true for so many of our other close relationships. Too much clinging, too much effort expended in monitoring the movement and controlling the activities of a friend or a colleague or a significant other, that will, in most instances, lead to greater resistance and an increased desire for separation, for distance. Letting go is largely about trust. Trust in the horse, trust in our children, trust in our spouse, but above all, trust in ourselves. As pioneers, we need to learn to have faith in our own ability to manage the unexpected, the unknown, and the unanticipated. In the end, the Buddha said, these things matter the most. How well did you love? How fully did you love? How deeply did you learn to let go? And this discipline can also produce some rather positive results in our professional and work lives. In reflecting recently on her own craft, the acclaimed novelist Barbara Kingsolver noted that she never read reviews after her books had been published. And it's not because she thought that she would be abashed by any negativity those reviews might contain. No, her worry was that she might be unduly influenced by the comments those reviewers made and thus deterred in the future from writing honestly about her subjects. And so she said, "I'll just concentrate on writing the best book I possibly can and then move on and let the controversy fall where it may." And in recent years, I have adopted much the same attitude toward my own duties as a minister. I pursue each of my assignments conscientiously. I commit to them to the degree that I can, as fully as I can. And when it's done, hey, it's done. Now, I think it's important to revel in one's successes and to learn something from one's mistakes. But neither of those outcomes should be taken too seriously, because with so many variables in play in any given situation, even an individual's best efforts might not produce the desired outcome. So do what you can. Let go. And personally, I have found that when the results matter less, the work itself becomes more intrinsically meaningful. Now, it should be noted at this point that letting go is not the same thing as giving up. It doesn't mean we throw in the towel. It doesn't mean we acquiesce or we surrender. And as an example of the latter, consider a movement that has arisen in recent years among disillusioned environmental activists. They're called collapsitarians. And these are folks who now believe that the problems humankind faces in terms of the environment are so overwhelming, irresolvable, that civilization as we know it is headed for a complete breakdown. And one of this movement's most notable figures is an Englishman named Paul Kingsnorth. And he accuses mainstream environmentalists of selling human beings a false premise. The mainstream environmentalists, he says, still insist that where there is a will, there is a way to avert environmental and economic meltdown. But Kingsnorth says that is a hollow promise. And our best resource as a species is to prepare now for a return to pre-technological Neolithic ways of life, which is what he himself has been doing in his adopted country of Ireland. And so he says, "These days, whenever I hear the word hope, I reach for my whiskey bottle." He's a collapsitarian. He believes that the environment, our whole civilization, is on the verge of collapse. And so they take this principle of letting go that I've been describing to an extreme. Douglas Hine compares it to coming to terms with a fatal illness that medical science has no answer for. By contrast, someone like Bill McKibben will argue that while we as human beings do need to let go of some of the amenities that we've grown accustomed to, a concerted effort to stabilize the environmental situation, that effort still has to be made. We have to be honest about what we can do, the Canadian environmentalist Naomi Klein says, but we do not have to accept failure. There are degrees as to how bad this thing can get. There are still degrees. So letting go is best understood as one of the two principles graphically illustrated by that classic Chinese symbol, the yin and the yang. On the one side, we have complete capitulation. On the other side, we have command and control. But neither principle by itself leads to a healthy relationship with nature, with our children, with our coworkers, or with the leaders of our faith communities. The mysterious marriage of choice and surrender, Howard Thurman once said, is a paradox at the heart of all human experience. To be human, he continues, we must insist on the right to cast our vote. And yet finally, the individual spirit must be grounded in an impulse to yield. May it be so for us as well. Blessed be and amen. Would you join me now in just a moment of reflective and contemplative silence?